Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture titled Charles Darwin on the Races of Man. Speaking will be Dr. Joseph Graves, Dean of Biological Sciences at North Carolina A&T University. Tonight's lecture is co-sponsored by Boston University's African American Studies Program and Department of History, the Humanities Foundation, and the Greater Boston Darwin Centennial. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of History, John Thornton.
I'm really pleased and proud to be able to introduce our speaker for you today, who's Dr. Joseph L. Graves, Jr. He's the Dean of University Studies and Professor of Biological Sciences at North Carolina A&T State University. He got his Ph.D. in Environmental Evolutionary and Systematic Biology at Wayne State University. That's in Detroit, for those of you that don't know. In 1988. In 1994, he was elected a fellow of the Council of American Association for the Advancement of Sciences. That's a biggie, guys. In April 2002, he received the ASU West Award for scholarly research and creative activity. His research concerns have been evolutionary genetics of postponed aging and biological concepts of race in humans, which is specifically what we want to deal with here today. He's written over 60 papers and books chapters and appeared in 6 documentary films. He's also been a principal investigator on grants from the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, and the Arizona Disease Research Commission. And in January 2006, he became a member of the New Genetics and African Slave Trade Working Group over at the Du Bois Institute at Harvard, which is chaired by Henry Louis Gates and Evelyn Hammonds. And I, too, serve on that committee. So this is actually where we first came in contact with each other. He's currently serving as interim chair and senior advisory board for the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center at Duke University. He's been an active participant in the struggle to protect and improve the teaching of science, particularly evolutionary biology, in the public schools, which means he's persona non grata in Kansas. Is that right? And North Carolina, where he happens to reside. In 2007, he became a member of the inaugural editorial board of Evolution, Education, and Outreach, published by Springer Verlag. In Germany. He has been a leader in addressing the underrepresentation of minorities in science careers, having directed successful programs in California and Arizona. He's a member of the board of Guilford Educational Alliance. From 2005 to 2009, he's been a leading force in aiding underserved youth in Greensboro via the YMCA chess program. So, with those distinguished credentials, I would like to present for you Dr. Joseph Graves.
Thank you. For those of you who are unaware of this fact, we are commemorating the International Year of Science, which recognizes the 400th anniversary of Galileo's invention of the telescope, the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin on February 12, 1809, and we are coming up on the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species, which first appeared in print edition on November 22nd of 1859. It is, in fact, this last event which serves as the basis for my discussion with you this afternoon. Now, given that this is commemorating the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, I want to highlight in this talk both Darwin's genius and his humanity. Some of you probably have not heard the term humanity associated with Charles Darwin before. That is not by accident. In fact, much of that has to do with the creationist attempts to undermine the teaching of evolution in the United States, which I will talk about at the end of my talk. Darwin's descent with modification vies for one of the most important scientific discoveries of the last millennium. In fact, other than Galileo and Copernicus's revolution, which changed our view of where the Earth stood in the universe, I really can think of no other scientific idea that comes close to the significance of descent with modification or organic evolution for the way humans now understand themselves and their origins. In The Emperor's New Clothes in 2001, I argued that all previously existing notions about the meaning and significance of human biological variation could not have been correct before the publication of On the Origin of Species. In other words, descent with modification is the only rational means by which we can understand human biological variation, and I'm going to demonstrate that in the course of today's lecture. Now, Desmond and Morris, in their recent book, Darwin's Sacred Cause, argue that it was precisely Darwin's opposition to chattel slavery that influenced his thinking about human biological variation and was part of his activism against slavery and racism. Again, something not well known in the United States because of attempts to undermine the teaching of evolution and the legacy of evolutionary theory. Darwin's anti-slavery views are well documented in one, the most authoritative biography written on Charles Darwin, at least in my view, by Desmond and Moore, Darwin, The Life of a Tormented Evolutionist, which was published in 1991, and their newest book, Darwin's Sacred Cause, How a Hatred of Slavery Shaped Darwin's Views on Human Evolution, which came out earlier this year. Now, to understand the significance of Charles Darwin's thinking, we need to recognize how people thought about species in 1831, right before Charles Darwin begins his thinking on species. The prevailing view of educated people of this time was that of natural theology. In natural theology, species were fixed, but they were special creations revealing God's divine plan, his beneficence for the world. Species were essential, going back to the ideas of the 4th century BC Greek philosopher Plato. In Plato's view of reality, variation was an illusion, and the views of naturalists really had not changed from Plato through his student Aristotle and then into the thinking of Western naturalists of the 19th century. The idea that variation was significant was anathema. Variation was illusion. The essential divine plan was up to the naturalists to define. Now, with regard to human variation, there were two main schools of thought. In the 1830s, monogenism was still predominant. In this, there is one act of creation, one Adam and Eve, and subsequent racial difference resulted from either environment or degeneration for whatever reasons. This is best illustrated in Pritchard's Researches into the Physical History of Mankind, which was one of the most authoritative and complete ethnological researches of the 19th century up to this point, published in 1826. Polygenism was beginning to gain more attention. This claimed that there were pre-Adamite races. In fact, this idea goes back to the Italian philosopher Giordano Bruno, who, when most people think of Bruno, they think of him in the context of his heliocentrism and his martyrdom on the basis of his support for the Copernican worldview. What most people don't know is that a great deal of the church's resistance to Giordano Bruno was not his heliocentrism. It was his adherence to the idea of the pre-Adamite races, that there were separate creations of men. Giordano Bruno thought it was absolutely impossible that an African and an Italian could share any sort of common ancestry. So, in the beginning of the middle of the 19th century, we begin to see the rise of polygenism, and it was favored by those, ironically, in opposition to religion, and it was claiming the scientific high ground, but of course in the context of natural theology, not in the context that Darwin would provide some 30 years later. Now, to understand further the thinking about race, we have to go back to Carolus Linnaeus in 1735. Linnaeus introduced the binomial classification, which if any of the students in the audience have taken a biology class, you're familiar with genus and species. Linnaeus describes in Systema Naturae four subspecies of humans. Homo sapiens americanus, which was found in the Americas, Homo sapiens europaeus, referring to Europeans, Homo sapiens asiaticus, Asians, and Homo sapiens afer, referring to Africans. Now, Linnaeus does not explain how these groups became different. One can read that he was a creationist. He thought that for whatever means, the groups were different. His classification scheme relied on morphological, that is, physical traits, and behavioral features. So Linnaeus saw Europeans as gentle and optimistic and inventive, while he characterized Asians as stiff and greedy. Of course, Homo sapiens afer was the most degraded and lowest form of humanity, which we will see as a constant theme throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, at least as described by European naturalists. Now, one of the things that is a real condemnation of Linnaeus's form of thought is that with regard to humans, he was really an armchair naturalist. He'd never really been outside of Europe. He'd never spoken to any Chinese people, never seen any Africans in Africa, never seen any Americans or indigenous Americans in America. So he relied mainly on the travel logs, which had been written by various European personalities who had traveled around the world and their impressions and their observations of the people that they came in contact with. Now, there was also another trend that described species, and that was transformationism. And transformationism is linked to the folks that we call the minor evolutionists. In particular, those of 18th century France and those that were influenced by Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. Now, Lamarck was Catholic. His views were that God had imbued all species with an intrinsic drive to improve. So for the transformationists, species and racial lineages, and Lamarck's followers saw 15 human racial lineages, were therefore distinct, going all the way back to protozoa. So God had basically started the system with single-celled, simple organisms, imbuing them with the ability to improve themselves, and Lamarck's mechanism was the inheritance of acquired characteristics. And through time, these various lineages would evolve or transform into new species. Boré de Saint-Vincent felt that today's chimpanzees would be tomorrow's humans. Thus, the two species did not share a common ancestor, and chimpanzees thus just not become humans yet. So this, of course, allows for racial hierarchy because different lineages would evolve at different rates. And again, the French naturalists of this time saw Europeans at the apex of human biological variation and Africans at the bottom. Their mechanism, or at least that of the transformationists, was different rates of evolution. Now, transformationism was not very popular in England for a number of reasons. History students in the audience will understand what period of history I'm talking about, and England and France didn't agree on much of anything, let alone the idea of these strange Catholics of species transforming through time. And in fact, Erasmus Darwin got into a great deal of trouble because he, in his book Zoonomia, argued the transformationist line, and of course, he was called a Bonapartist and was threatened and with imprisonment and so forth. So, now, in The Emperor's New Clothes, I summarize the writings of 18th century and 19th century naturalists on race, especially with regard to the Negro. And again, I'm using the historical term in its historical context. So, along the voyage of the Beagle, he became convinced that species were not fixed. Now, Darwin, again, by all measures, was an absolute genius. To be able to put together the reasoning, to be able to collect the specimens, to be able to formulate testable hypotheses at this age, on this voyage, under these conditions, is an absolutely amazing feat. And he becomes very committed to the notion that species are not fixed and change through time. So shortly after his arrival back in England, he begins the transmutation notebooks. He knew that transmutation would put him in conflict with all his scientific mentors and by extension, all of English society. So he realized from the very start that transmutation would have profound implications for human genealogy. During the voyages, he had begun to formulate these ideas about the origin and varieties of the human species. He had observed both slavery and genocide against indigenous populations. So from all this, he works through the notion that species have changed through time, and he understands the implications of this. One of the great mysteries in the history of science is why did Charles Darwin take so long when he actually had worked out the gross outlines of transmutation theory in 1837 to actually publish on the origin of species. There have been a number of hypotheses put forward. The biographies of Darwin make it very clear, and again, pointing to Desmond and Morris, that this entire topic tortured him for 20 years. That much of the reason why he did not advance this theory was because he was unwilling to accept the ostracism and the damage to his good family name that would result from him being associated with these ideas. Yet at the same time, he was interested in this as an intellectual question. He also understands its significance with regard to a social issue that's of great importance to him, that is, the abolition of slavery. So, what does Darwin do between 1837 and 1859? Well, he wished first to establish his position in British science. Now, again, this may not be so clear, the significance and importance of this may not be so clear to 21st century students who live in a world in which the edifice of science is established in its dominance over technology, its significance to society is so well established. This was not the case in the middle of the 19th century. And, of course, remember that Britain is one of the most advanced industrial nations in the world. At this time, science is mainly the province of the landed gentry and of the church parson. Great universities do not have science faculties of 50 to 100 people with massive laboratories, with huge government expenditures and budgets. That simply did not exist. Things that we take for granted today, such as the journal Nature, didn't exist then. It was actually started by Darwin and his cohorts. So one thing he wanted to do, knowing that this transmutation claim was going to be so radical, so transformative, and so resisted, he wanted to first establish his position in British science as unassailable. Remember, at this time, he's still a very young man. He realized what sorts of evidence were required to make an overwhelming case for transmutation. He realized that that evidence hadn't been collected yet. He realized the experiments hadn't been done yet. So he sets out collecting the evidence and doing the experiments, which take him close to 20 years. He also realized that he needed to make an overwhelming case for natural selection. Again, without the experiments, without the evidence, he would have been lambasted. So 20 years worth of work to establish the evidence required to make the case for natural selection. Finally, he was deathly afraid of taking a position on human evolution and therefore, by extension, human racial biology. The two went hand in hand, and he knew it. So, how does he go about making the case for evolution? Well, one of the things that, again, historians are often puzzled by is the fact that he worked for about 6 years on a monograph on the Cirripedia, or barnacles. But actually, this had a twofold benefit. First, after the publication of his voyages, which came out in 3 volumes, this set him on the British stage as a naturalist of top order. And if I remember correctly, and someone could correct me on this, he received his Copley Medal, which was one of the highest awards in British science, mainly on the basis of the Cirripedia monograph. Now, this group of organisms, however, also provided him with some of the most amazing and incontrovertible examples of natural selection, and also a new mechanism, which he would later develop, sexual selection. So, for example, he found a species of barnacle in which the males were wholly parasitic upon the females. They did nothing else. Their entire life history involved attaching themselves to a female and producing sperm cells to fertilize the female's eggs. He argued that a special creationist explanation was beyond any reasonable mind for this state of affairs, but that, in fact, looking at it from the point of view of natural selection, this made perfect sense. And I will also state that we now have seen the existence of parasitic males in numerous invertebrate taxa. So if this only happened in barnacles, you might say, well, Darwin caught a fluke. But in fact, the existence of parasitic males is widespread in a number of taxonomic groups. And again, it makes perfect sense. And I know there are some women in this audience saying, well, humans probably have parasitic males too. But I probably wouldn't go that far. But having said that, there are a number of other taxons in which parasitic males are standard. So at the same time that Darwin is building his case for transmutation, events were unfolding in the social struggle over slavery. Events which were influenced by how one understood variation, the species question itself. Charles Darwin followed these events closely through his connection to English abolitionism and to his scientific colleagues who were engaged in the scientific, and I put that in quotes, issues aligned with slaveholder interests. In fact, his mentor, Sir Charles Lyell, the author of Principles of Physical Geology, the scion of British science, was closely aligned with Louis Agassiz of Harvard University, Samuel Morton of the Pennsylvania Medical College, and the other polygenists in the United States. Lyell was an apologist for their actions, and Darwin condemned him for that. Now, indeed, Darwin's work on the origin was concluding just as the crisis in American slavery was reaching its peak. So, to understand that, I run through the four horsemen of polygeny: Louis Agassiz, the Swiss-born naturalist, Harvard professor, the theorist of polygeny; Samuel Morton, professor of anatomy, Pennsylvania Medical College. He was the experimentalist. He published Crania Americana in 1839, which was his comparison of thousands of skulls of indigenous people from around the world, mostly Amerindians. Now, of course, those of you, again, who are students of history, can explain how it was that Samuel Morton had so many Amerindian skulls to work with. Josiah Nott, the popularizer of polygeny, Southern gentleman, physician, and renowned throughout the American South for his lectures on niggerology. His term, not mine. George R. Glidden, who was the United States Consul in Cairo, who plundered tombs, stealing Egyptian mummy heads, and supplying Morton with 137 Egyptian skulls, which would be used in Morton's later publication, Crania Egyptica. So, Knott and Glidden published Types of Mankind in 1854. This book is based upon Louis Agassiz's Zones of Creation. And in it you see that all animals and plants and races are created in a particular zone around the world. Agassiz argues that those people were not meant to be moved from their zones. And hence, Knott argues that Africans could not adapt to North America. Therefore, slavery was a benign institution helping them to survive. He showed data from insurance companies illustrating the higher mortality of blacks in the north and the lower mortality as you went south into slavery, both making the point that the southern climate was closer to the African tropical climate, and the institution of slavery was the benign means by which these Africans could survive outside of a climate that they were never meant to be taken out of. Darwin and Agassiz stand on opposite poles of the thinking about the species question. Darwin knew that Agassiz was his main opponent. And that, in fact, he tried to cultivate various professors in the United States to be his agent to help him deal with what he knew would be Agassiz's attack on the origin of species. In fact, the word he used in his memoirs was that Agassiz will throw a boulder at me. He first tried a professor at Yale, but he ended up teaming up with Asa Gray, professor of botany at Harvard University here in Cambridge, Boston area. So how do Darwin and Agassiz differ? Well, Agassiz was a believer in catastrophism. He thought that there were great catastrophes in the history of the earth, which explained the destruction of previous species and therefore required new special acts of creation. Now, this was a very important tact for defenders of creationism to take by the middle of the 19th century. In the middle of the 18th century, these creationists were still denying that the fossil record was a record of former life on this planet. So once the fossils began to accumulate and it became clear that these fossils were the remnants of living things, the tactic of creationists began to shift. All right, we can no longer deny that these things are real. Now that they're real, we have to come up with a way to explain how a creator would leave this record of life changing through the geological epochs. Catastrophism was that solution. Based upon the Noachian flood, an example of a worldwide catastrophe that killed all species, the catastrophists argued that there had been previous mass extinctions on a global or regional scale, therefore requiring zones of creation. So new species would be created, and so therefore there was no descent with modification. Human races themselves were separate creations, and therefore blacks were a separate species. Agassiz himself opposed slavery, but this was because of his aversion to blacks. He writes in his journals of how he felt the first time he came in contact with a person of African descent and how sickened he was by their sight, by their odor, by their unkempt character, by their lack of intelligence. He goes on and on and on. So for Agassiz, he opposes slavery because he simply doesn't want Africans in the New World. Now, the Count de Gobineau, who wrote the moral and intellectual diversity of races, which essentially assembled all human history under the guise of the interaction of race. Civilizations rose and fell based on race. Racially pure civilizations extended themselves, survived longer. Great civilizations declined because they allowed impure outside races to pull them down. Okay, and the moral intellectual diversity of races by the Count de Gouvenau was translated into English by none other than Josiah Nott and another one of Agassiz's compatriots, Henry Horza, in 1856. Now, on the other hand, Darwin lived and operated in a wide anti-slavery circle. For example, the whole course of American politics is determined by the slavery question. This is from Harriet Martineau's letters, published in 1854. This was her response to the Dred Scott decision and the ongoing civil war in Kansas. Martineau is known as a feminist abolitionist and was a lover confidant to Erasmus Darwin, and this is Charles' older brother, not his grandfather, and a personal friend to Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner. So again, Darwin's circle was somewhat different from that of the ASL, the Schnotts and Gliddens and the Agassizes of the world. So, in a letter to Alfred Russel Wallace in 1857, addressing the question that Wallace sent to Darwin, would human evolution be included in the Origin of Species? Darwin's response, I think I shall avoid the whole subject, as it was too surrounded with prejudices, even if humans do pose the biggest or highest and most interesting problem for the naturalist. But yet the elephant was there in the origin, whether Darwin wanted it to be or not. His chapter on hybrids was partially, and some scholars argue, mainly directed at the polygenist claims of Nott and Glidden. In the distant future, I see open fields for far more important researches. Psychology will be based on a new foundation, that of necessary acquirement of each mental power and capacity by gradation. Light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. This is in the conclusion of The Origin of Species. But the real event, at least pointed to by his biographers, was the actions of Governor Eyre in Jamaica in putting down a rebellion of free blacks where English troops massacred over 439 people. There were 600 floggings, 1,000 homes burned, and a huge division in English society about the actions of the governor and whether they could be supported. Charles Darwin himself became part of a committee trying to bring Eyre to trial for these atrocities, and he donated money to get an attorney to bring the charges. He comes into his own dispute with his own son, William, who is lauding Eyre's actions in defense of the British Empire. And it was this event, combined with his mentor Lyell's unwillingness to support his views on evolution and on human evolution in particular, that really drove Darwin to the point of saying, okay, I now can no longer avoid this subject. And he now has also arrived at what he believes is a mechanism that can explain human evolution and the origin and diversification of races, sexual selection. These things all come together in 1866, and he begins The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, which would be published in 1871. He talks about his own personal relationships with persons who were not European, like John, the person who taught him to preserve specimens, like the Fijians who were aboard the Beagle, and others that he knew, free men that he'd met in London, and so forth. So, he emphasizes that humans are much more alike than they are different. He also points out in his chapter on human races, he actually even doubts that if you applied the same characteristics or criteria that we use to define races in non-human species to humans, that we would even say that human races exist. So in other words, he doubts the notion that humans were real, races were real. He described the racial multiplication problem. Darwin isn't completely progressive in The Descent of Man. He rationalized the extinction of less civilized races within the context of natural selection. He didn't say that this was a moral thing. He didn't say it was a good thing, because in Darwin's mind, natural selection doesn't take moral positions. It is what it is. It does what it does. Now, he called human races protean or polymorphic. Polymorphic means that an organism shows many different forms. Now, he pointed out that most of the physical differences noticed by naturalists could not have any significance. If they would, they would have been removed by natural selection. In other words, if these differences were important, natural selection would eliminate them. The fact that they haven't been eliminated by natural selection means that they have no significance. Now, he then, at the end of this work, invokes the mechanism of sexual selection. Sexual selection involves the traits that males and females of a species utilize to determine whom is a suitable mate. What he does in this work is give an unassailable case for the operation of sexual selection in nature, in plants, in animals. The evidence is overwhelming. Okay, and in the last 150 years, we've built upon that evidence showing that sexual selection is a real thing. Sexual selection goes on in our species as well. However, Darwin thinks that sexual selection was a mechanism that caused the polymorphic differences we see in modern humans. And I'm going to demonstrate later in this discussion that that's where he makes a major mistake. So, sexual selection is real. The Descent of Man makes an overwhelming case that it's real. Subsequent research has demonstrated that it's real. But Darwin applies it incorrectly. It isn't a major factor, at least not in recent time, in contributing to the variation that we see associated with human populations. So, now, I'd like to end this talk tonight with the big question. Did Darwin get it right? Natural selection follows from the following facts. And these are things that he could establish in his time. First, individuals within populations are variable. So in other words, he was able to overturn the Platonic essentialism of the mid-19th century. By the time the origin, the descent of man, domestication of animals and plants, etc., have all been published, no reasonable naturalist disagrees that individuals within populations are variable, and especially with regard to traits that influence survival and reproduction. This is called the principle of variation. Premise two, variation among individuals are in part passed to offspring. This is called the principle of heredity, or offspring resemble their parents. Premise three, in nature, more offspring are born than can possibly survive. This is called the struggle for existence. Now, this is based upon the writings of the 18th century English economist Thomas Malthus. Malthus applied the struggle for existence to human populations and human economies, explaining depressions, recessions, poverty, etc. His application, or Malthus's application, human populations is questionable, but the existence of the struggle for existence is not. So, why did Darwin get some aspects of human evolution wrong? First, Darwin did not understand heredity. Darwin understood that there was a mechanism of heredity. The mechanism that he thought existed was false. He believed in something called pangenesis, which is incorrect. It doesn't invalidate the Darwinian syllogism. The Darwinian syllogism only requires that there's a mechanism of heredity. It doesn't tell you what that mechanism is, nor does it need to. However, to be able to understand human biological variation or the biological variation that we actually see in real-world populations, you do have to get the mechanism of heredity correct. Now, ironically, Mendel's seminal paper explaining the basic rules of particulate inheritance was published in 1866. And for people who think that Gregor Mendel was a Catholic monk who one day, you know, blundered on the rules of heredity in his garden, think again. Gregor Mendel was a student of a professor at the University of Vienna named Hans Strasser, who was a absolutely committed evolutionist. And Mendel was interested in finding the mechanisms of heredity precisely to establish how it operates with regard to the production of new varieties. Mendel was highly trained in physics, statistical thinking, and mathematics. So he wasn't just this old father who was out there one day and figured out, oh, wow, 3 and 1, huh? That must mean that there are, you know, biparental gametes. No, it's not how it happened. So this paper was actually published in German, and unfortunately Charles Darwin didn't read German. The paper actually doesn't get discovered or rediscovered by English naturalists involving evolutionary theory and natural selection until the turn of the 20th century. And then later, the neo-Darwinian synthesis was really symbolized by the publication of Sir Ronald A. Fisher's Genetical Theory of Natural Selection in 1936, brings together how Mendelian genetics and Darwinian natural selection actually operates. So Darwin doesn't have this. So the nature of the genetic code itself is not discovered until the 1960s. These are crucial to correctly understand human biological variation. I'll give you an example. Darwin rejected skin color as resulting from natural selection. This was his reasoning in The Descent. Of all the differences between the races of man, color of skin is the most conspicuous and one of the best marked. Differences of this kind could be accounted for by long exposure under different climates. This view has been chiefly rejected because the distribution of the variously colored races does not coincide with corresponding differences in climate. Now, behind this mistake is a Lamarckian conception of genetics, which he hadn't freed himself of even by the 1870s. The notion here, and that one of the criticisms against Pritchard's work, was that people with light skin who moved to the tropics, and now we've had colonial administrators in the tropics now for 3 centuries, that in fact their skin color should change to fit the climate. So this was an idea based upon the inheritance of an acquired characteristic. So all the people who had looked at skin color in the tropics were expecting that if skin color was the result of environment, that white folks would have changed to black folk by now. And when they didn't see that, their conclusion was, well, skin color can't be the result of environment. Since Darwin believes that natural selection is mediated by the environment, and skin colors don't match climate, he rejects skin color as being the result of natural selection. having rejected natural selection, he has only one other mechanism, sexual selection. And so with this sort of most powerful case rejected, he says, all right, I've given you the best case scenario, and natural selection can't explain it. So therefore, if my transmutationism is correct, it's got to be sexual selection. Well, in fact, he was wrong. Natural selection does determine skin color. Darwin didn't know that. Hence, him pursuing sexual selection as a cause of human racial differentiation. Okay? So, natural selection does explain skin color variation. It also explains disease frequency, which was another thing that Darwin looked at in The Descent of Man. In this case, we see the sickle cell anemia allele is associated with the presence of malaria. This is a common mistake that people make, thinking that sickle cell anemia is associated with so-called race. No, it's associated with the presence of malaria. It's found in Greece, it's found in Yemen, it's found in India. So it's associated with the presence or absence of malaria. So sickle cell anemia has absolutely nothing to do with someone's socially constructed race. To understand that more thoroughly, you need to read my second book called The Race Myth. So if we had imported East Indian or Yemeni slaves, this country would be talking about the Yemeni disease of sickle cell anemia. But the slaves came from the west and central portions of Africa. So for this reason, human populations are mixtures and matches of different traits, none of which can be used to define racial groups, and we can't do it using genes either. So, another thing that Darwin got wrong was the relationship between genes, environment, and culture. And this, again, can be linked to principle two, heredity. Darwin understood this at the most rudimentary level. Offspring resemble parents. Well, in this case, particularly when we're talking about a complex genetically determined physical trait or behavior, it is important to know how offspring resemble their parents. So Darwin's ignorance of the way genes and environment interact led him to some false conclusions about culture. So in The Emperor, first version, 2001, outlined the development of the subsequent scientific and social movements that claimed the imprimatur of Darwin. For example, the other day on the news in the Triad, where I live in North Carolina, the news anchor attributed Charles Darwin with being the father of eugenics. Nothing could be further from the truth. Okay, the founding individual behind the eugenics movement was Charles Darwin's cousin, Sir Francis Galton. And Charles Darwin himself, while he may have again had some naive genetic ideas, never really was interested in pursuing the controlled breeding of the lower classes. In fact, most of the things he did in his life were philanthropic towards people who were underprivileged. So he had absolutely nothing to do with the eugenics movement that developed in the UK and then later developed in the United States. Social Darwinism. Again, in my book, I argue that this term should be scrapped because Darwin didn't have anything to do with this. Whenever we evaluate the impact of a scientific theory, we need to evaluate both the theory itself, what it says, what its claims are, what is the evidence supporting it, and the actions of its practitioners. Charles Darwin provided the world one of the greatest scientific ideas in history. Again, other than Galileo, I can't think of one of higher significance. Most of you have now seen many fictionalized accounts of the world coming to an end as a result of an asteroid impact. You wouldn't know about that possibility if it wasn't for my discipline. Most of you have taken vaccines this year, or will be taking them, to resist H1N1 flu. You would have no understanding of how such a thing could happen if it wasn't for my discipline. So, I can go on. Evolutionary biology is absolutely essential to the survival of modern human beings. However, like all scientific theories, it can be applied for evil or good. Do we blame Sir Isaac Newton every time a kid gets shot on the street? Without Newtonian mechanics, can't build a gun. But is Newton responsible for those that do and those that pull the trigger? No one would advance that argument. But yet Charles Darwin has been vilified and pilloried throughout the United States over and over again. In my travels in Europe, of course, it's a completely different story. Most of you probably know, Darwin is buried in Westminster Abbey alongside of Charles Lyell. He's also on the British 10-pound note, considered one of the greatest scientists in the history of the UK. So, with that, I thank you all for your attention, and I appreciate this opportunity to be here tonight.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've been listening to a lecture titled Charles Darwin on the Races of Man. Our speaker was Dr. Joseph Graves, Dean of Biological Sciences at North Carolina A&T University. Tonight's lecture was co-sponsored by Boston University's African American Studies Program and Department of History, the Humanities Foundation, and the Greater Boston Darwin Centennial. We began with an introduction by Boston University History Professor John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Ryan Peterson. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.